So we're dealing with the problem of the directionality of the reactions that are necessary for life. We're making two E. coli out of one. And we saw that one out of two ways, we'll see the second way in just a few minutes, one of the two ways that life has figured out a way to get a product whose simple synthesis would be unfavorable is to make a more complicated reaction, a coupled reaction, that utilizes ATP. And so in this more complicated coupled reaction, the delta G naught is favorable, and so the reaction goes at the expense of ATP hydrolysis. And now, in order to get that ATP regenerated from the ADP, that is the product of this energy-producing reaction, we have to have a way to make ATP from ADP and glycolysis. We saw after an investment of some ATP gives us a net synthesis of two ATPs for every glucose molecule that goes in here, and we ended up at pyruvate last time, and that's the end of the glycolysis, these 10 reactions. Now, we want to consider if we've tied up all our loose ends. So the ATP has been tied up. There's no problem getting ADP because all those reactions, those endergonic reactions that are now coupled to become exergonic, are producing ADP all the time. Phosphate is no problem because it's in the medium. You need phosphate. And it is provided for us to live. But we have this other loose end here. We had to introduce an NAD in this important reaction that gave us our first squiggle phosphate high-energy bond. NAD was related to the vitamin niacin. These small molecules are present in very small amounts in the cell. There's a little pool of them. And in a few seconds, if we didn't have a way to bring NADH2 and regenerate NAD for another step in this pathway, we'd be in trouble. So just like with ATP, analogously to ATP going to ADP, we have to have a way to go from NADH to NAD. So that's an oxidation. So here, NAD got reduced as it oxidized glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. And so now we have to reoxidize NADH2. So we need a good oxidizing agent. There's a great oxidizing agent that's prevalent on this planet, and it's oxygen. Oxygen's very reactive, and you see how things burn with the least provocation. So with oxygen, there's no problem. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, how NADH2 goes back to NAD by using oxygen. And it's a complex, very fascinating story. But suppose you didn't have oxygen. Can you live without oxygen? Yes, you can. So E. coli, for example, it doesn't have such great access to oxygen when it's living in a dog's colon. If it's going to be far from the bloodstream, can it grow without oxygen? Yes. Plus, there's thousands of species of bacteria that live in mud in the bottom of lakes. There's no oxygen. You can still grow without oxygen. Plus, there's other ways we don't talk about. But there's a major way it can grow without oxygen, and that just continues from here. Even us. We breathe in. Seems like we have plenty of oxygen, but do you ever get out of breath? If you're running here from Broadway to hear my first golden words, and you're running very fast, what happens? You run. And pretty soon you're breathing hard, and you can't get enough oxygen in to power the muscles, which are just using up that ATP like crazy to give you mechanical motion and contraction of your muscles. So indeed, you have you don't have enough oxygen to regenerate your NAD using oxygen if you're stressing your muscles. And so you invoke another way to do it. So that's all a preamble to what we're going to discuss now. So even we do it. So the way we do it and the way E. coli does it is we use an alternative oxidizing agent. So all we have is minimal medium for E. coli, to make it simple. So the only thing that we have left really net is all this pyruvic acid. Could pyruvic acid be an oxidizing agent? Actually, a very good oxidizing agent, because this C double bond O can accept in a very favorable reaction a couple of hydrogens with their electrons across here to form in this case, with their protons, so the hydrogen atoms, CHOH. So, and that's exactly what happens. There's an enzyme that catalyzes this very well called lactate dehydrogenase. It's named for the reverse reaction. But The reaction is actually energetically favorable to the left here. And so the pyruvic acid is converted to lactic acid. The NADH that was produced up here gets reoxidized to NAD, so it loses its electrons, and the NAD can then go back. And as long as for every pyruvate molecule, you can do an NAD molecule, and you have plenty of pyruvate, one, two for every glucose. Indeed, you use two over here because you had two glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates, and you got two pyruvates, and from that you can reoxidize two NADHs, so it's just an even trade. So I have a little animation for that. No, I don't. Okay, too bad. Anyway, just a bunch of arrows that are like going up here, and these arrows are going down here. They're kind of shimmering. Now, actually, I'm a little ahead of myself. If we consider the energetics of going to pyruvate, so let's back up a minute. If we consider the energetics of going to pyruvate, and we just look at this reaction, including the net two ADPs going to ATPs. So everything included, and you're stopping at pyruvate, the delta G naught of that set of reactions is minus 18 kilocalories per mole. So this is a hallmark of a metabolic pathway. If it's a pathway, and it's going to make something good, and it's used, then the delta G naught is going to be negative, and it's going to be large. So this pathway goes essentially completely to the right with this big free energy change. So all these transformations of glucose are actually driving this reaction. Let's take a closer look at each of those. So here's that first reaction. Now here we have an energy diagram. Here's the minus 18 that we're going to end up with two bars, with two pyruvates for every glucose. And we see the glucose, what reaction is this? That's the phosphorylation with ATP, hexokinase. We already talked about that, and we know, remember, it's about minus 3 point something, right? And indeed, that's what it is. So that's favorable. Next one's about even. Next one's favorable. But what about reaction 4? Reaction 4, highly unfavorable. Look at this difference, like minus, like plus 7 or something, right? So how are we going to get around this? This is not a coupled reaction. This is the reaction, and that is the delta G naught. The delta G naught, right? Not the delta G. We have two of these, then another unfavorable one, and another unfavorable one. So look at this big mountain of unfavorable positive delta G going from whatever this is after the third reaction up to this, which is 1,3-diphosphoglyceric acid, I believe. Doesn't matter. The point is, it's way up here. The next one, wow, no problem with that one. So what's happening here? Think about these guys up here facing this reaction. There's enzymes at every step. The speed is not the problem. But the directionality of this reaction is whopping to the right. So as soon as anything is made here, and soon because the enzyme is there, it is driven down here and is driven to essentially completeness. So what's the concentration of this stuff after reaction 7? Concentration is very, very low. Let's say it was 0. What if the concentration were 0? If it were 0, think of the delta G equation. Delta G equals delta G naught, blah, blah. It would be the log of minus the log of 0. So that's minus infinity. So the delta G would be minus infinity. Okay, this is not true. It's minus infinity because it's not 0. It's some small number. But if you make that number, could be very small. It could be 10 to the minus 7th. And that 7 now is going to end up roughly in the delta G category. So you have a delta G naught that is, you know, plus, here in this case, you know, plus 4, right? But you have a concentration here that is 10 to the minus 7th, right? So you're going to have roughly, you could figure it out, and it'll be problems. We have to figure this out. It'll be 7 minus 4. It'll be about minus 3 in the right direction. Okay. So I'm just trying to, I don't want to emphasize too much in the lecture. We can't go through the this quantitatively, but the idea is that these guys are pulled down here by the delta G as opposed to the delta G naught. And the same thing's now going to happen here because these guys are going to get pulled along with it. So the important thing is, then we have the same business, we have something up here, and then this whopping thing down here. So the important thing is that glucose is over here, and pyruvate is over there. And I sort of foreshadowed this a little bit when I said the directionality and the delta G even the delta G naught of a reaction depends only on its starting point and its ending point. It doesn't matter what's happening in between. Right? So this is what's driving. This 18 kilocalories per mole released is what's driving this reaction. And these temporary mountains are not a problem because delta G takes care of it in Gibbs's fanciful scheme. Right? And it works. Yes, this works. Right? It goes essentially completely to the right. And so this is the second way that unfavorable, individual unfavorable reactions overcome, the unfavorabilityness is overcome by having more favorable reactions downstream. You could make some argument about pushing from the other side also and building up, but this is really, I think, the better way to look at it is pulling. That's sort of inefficient if you have to build up huge pools. Here it's quite efficient. You just drain it and pull it forward. So we have coupled reactions for individual reactions make more complicated reactions. And then we have... Whoa. But you were seeing the light. I'm doing nothing. Okay, I think this will just remind you what I'm talking about. This is all what I said. So I'm not going to dwell on it. Look at it later. Said all that. Now we can go back to the NAD problem that I introduced prematurely. I said all this. And there's our reaction. That important reaction of pyruvate going to lactate in E. coli. Not everybody does it this way. Deals with this final step after glycolysis to reoxidize the NADH2. Once you do that, the pathway is called fermentation. So we can ferment glucose in our muscles if we have to. And E. coli can grow quite happily, not as fast, but quite happily in the absence of oxygen. In the lab, when we grow E. coli, we're always growing them on these shakers that are going very fast, so we get all the oxygen from the air into the solution. But if we put nitrogen in there and seal them up and just sat them on at 37 degrees in an incubator, they would be perfectly happy. They would grow maybe not an hour in minimal media, maybe 2 hour doubling time, I don't know for sure. But they can grow fine, just getting those two ATPs per glucose molecule. It seems puny, but it's sufficient because they can just run the glycolysis. So what happens if they just keep running the glycolysis? You keep spewing out not pyruvate, but lactic acid, this acid. So maybe they wouldn't grow as far because you'd build up this acid, the pH would drop, and they'd be in trouble. Just as we're in trouble, after you run over from Broadway, your legs hurt, supposedly because the lactic acid is building up in your muscles, and the acidity triggers your pain neurons to say, this is painful. Okay, so here's the one with the fancy arrows. Back and forth, get the idea. And now this is the overview. That in the absence of oxygen, you get the pyruvate, it goes to lactate, which is then excreted. That is a final end product. And then our last loose end is finished, and we have a perfectly good metabolic pathway for generating ATP, solving that problem. In yeast, for example, we pick yeast because it's out there in our real world, both in the laboratory and in the marketplace. So in yeast, it's done a little differently. First, there's this. Oh, not work anymore. First, there's a, from this pyruvic acid, there's a splitting off of this CO2, and the H just goes down here. So you might recognize this is a detail of that. That's just an aldehyde group, just like the top of glucose, just acetaldehyde, right? And the CO2 just bubbles off. The acetaldehyde then is this double bond that gets reduced, and the NADH2 gets oxidized, accepts these two electrons, and now you have CH3CH2OH, and that's ethanol. So the CO2 is useful if you're a baker. So CO2 comes off and raises your bread. You put some yeast in it, right? Ethanol is good if you're a beer drinker, because, or wine, actually, a drinker, because you have this ethanol produced, which is a lot more pleasant than lactic acid and also has different psychopharmacological effects. So yeast is it's hard to overestimate the importance of yeast, right? Then there's other kinds. So that would be called ethanolic fermentation in yeast. And you don't have both. You have one way to do it in general. Either you do it with lactate, or you do it with ethanol, or there's other ways, like Swiss cheese, you make propionic acid, gives it that sharp taste. How about the efficiency now? Glucose now in fermentation, which completed the story, we have no loose ends. If we consider this reaction, just glucose going to lactate, and don't consider the cost, the energetic cost of making those two ATPs, just as a thought experiment. With no harnessing of the energy to make ATPs, the delta G naught of this converted to of glucose converted to two lactates is minus 45 kilocalories per mole. So, but of course we don't get all that released because we capture some of it. How much do we capture? We capture enough to make two ATPs. We capture 14 of that. So, out of the potential of 45, we captured 14. That's about 30% efficiency, which is about the same as our nice gasoline engines that we have in our cars, about 30%. What happened to the other 31 kilocalories per mole? It's all lost as heat. Just as it's lost in your gasoline engine, it's very hot. You have to get rid of that with a cooling system, you have to get rid of that heat. So in our bodies also, if you're in your legs, when you're running here, not only do you have pain, but you've released all this heat, and you're sweating profusely. So you also have to get rid of that heat. If we take those ATPs into account, now for fermentation, remember just for glycolysis was minus 18. For fermentation, going all the way to lactate, it's minus 31, as we just saw. So that last reaction is very favorable. It's the difference between 18 and 31, what is about 13 kilocalories per mole to make lactate out of pyruvate and the NAD and ADH2. So there's no problem with directionality here, as there isn't for any metabolic pathway that we see, because these are the ones that work. Okay, but let's take the more. Let's take a. So I've tried to emphasize that all of these things make sense. That if you borrow NAD, you have to pay it back. If you borrow ATP, you have to pay it back. It's all one organized set of reactions that makes chemical sense. Let's consider now, for the first time, something other than glucose minimal medium. Let's consider some other source of energy. How about glycerol? Because we know this molecule from fats. Glycerol is sort of like a sugar, except it doesn't have that C double bond O. So it's a polyalcohol. Can E. coli grow on glycerol? Yes, it can. Again, we need the investment of an ATP to phosphorylate. Now we got it phosphorylated, and we have glycerol phosphate. Now we have an enzyme that operates with NAD as the oxidizing agent, takes off these two hydrogens with their electrons, and we have now a three-carbon compound with phosphate at one end, an OH at the other end, C double bond O in the middle. Does that look vaguely familiar? Yes, that's dihydroxyacetone phosphate. So now we're right there in the glycolytic pathway. We came in by a different route. We didn't go through glucose. We came in at step four. Right? In step five, this is going to get isomerized to glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, and then we're golden. We can make ATP. So let's take a look at that integration into glycolysis. We do have to worry about this NAD, right? Going to NADH2, but in the presence of oxygen, that's no problem. We have we can bring this back to NAD with excess oxygen. How about in the absence of oxygen? So let's consider it here in graphic 16. So this is just a synopsis of the reaction I just showed you. An investment of ATP we have to worry about now is re-worry about these things. NAD go to NH2, so we have to pay these back. But now we're in this pathway, so we're going to go down here, and sure enough, we're going to get two ATPs out. For every glycerol molecule, we invested one ATP, and we get down here. There's one. There's our two regular ATP-producing reactions, 7 and 10. So ATP is no problem. There's one net ATP made for every glycerol molecule that goes through this pathway. Right. How about the NAD? NAD, we go down here. Then we need another NAD over here to make 1,3-diphosphoglyceric acid. But when we get down to pyruvate, we can just make our lactate and get back NAD. So no problem, right? Wrong. This is an NAD here, an NAD here. We owe two. We owe two NADs. Our reaction down here is only giving us one. So, well, okay, we'll just run some more up here. If we run more up here, every time we run up here, it gets worse because we have another one that we owe. We're borrowing two, paying back one. Borrowing two, paying back one. In a very, very short time, we will run out of NAD. So we can't borrow more than we can pay back, just like real life. Right? A bankrupt E. coli cell is dead. So the conclusion is, prediction would be that if you put glycerol and you put nitrogen instead of oxygen in your E. coli culture and fed it glycerol instead of glucose, it will not grow. And that is the fact. It will not grow. It will not ferment glycerol. Glycerol is a non-fermentable carbon source for E. coli. It'll grow fine if we had some other way to deal with this NAD, like oxygen. It grows fine in oxygen. But you see, the rules, it doesn't adhere to the rules. It borrowed more than it could pay back. So there are fermentable carbon sources, and there are non-fermentable carbon sources. That is, I can't draw you a pathway for glycerol to make it fermentable. It may seem that, well, I'm just can write any of these reactions and come out what we want in the end. We can't. We have to play by the rules. That's the energy efficiency we just decided was about 30% for what we had to work with. What about the energy yield? That is, what's the potential energy that we have, chemical energy that we have in a molecule of glucose? We'll go back to glucose now. If we would completely burn glucose, set our sugar cube on fire, right? It would burn, and it would release a lot of heat. Indeed, the conversion of glucose, all six carbons with oxygen here, to CO2 and water, 686 kilocalories per mole. Here we used only 45 of them, right? So it's inefficient with respect to the reactions we did were pretty efficient, 30%, but it's inefficient with respect to what potentially we had, the energy of breaking those glucose bonds, oxidizing that glucose, essentially. And indeed, if we use oxygen, we're going to get, if we use oxygen, we can tap into a lot more energy that's inherent in that glucose molecule. But now, pyruvate's going to take a different pathway. It's going to jump from handout of glycolysis to the handout 8.1 of the Krebs cycle, which you have for today. Now, this is a cyclical series of reactions. So let's follow the fate of pyruvate now. And since you're kind of used to, I'll go a little bit faster. Since you're kind of used to these small changes, I'll just mention them briefly. So here's our pyruvate, CH3, CO1O, COOH. And the very first reaction, we start to oxidize. What's going to happen in the Krebs cycle is we're going to take that take that glucose molecule, now in the form of two pyruvates, and we're going to convert it completely to CO2. The overall reaction is glucose goes to CO2 plus water. Glucose plus oxygen goes to CO2 plus water. In the Krebs cycle, we're going to see the CO2 come off, but we're not going to see any oxygen used. We're not going to see any water produced net. and we're going to see very little ATP. So this is just a prelude to the real tapping in and getting a lot of ATP out of this process. So again, we use an NAD, and we're putting off. We say we don't have to worry about paying back NADH2 until the end, and we're going to use oxygen somehow for that. So we build up more NADH2. We already have 2 per glucose a debt from glycolysis, remember. Now we have these CoA. That's not a carbon. This is coenzyme A. I think I have a picture of coenzyme A. It's another vitamin-related thing. Well, I guess we'll see it in a minute. The coenzyme A attaches to this carboxyl in kind of something like an ester. You'll see it in a minute in more detail. And it turns out this is actually a high energy bond. I don't know if it's necessary here. And it's only these first 2 carbons of pyruvate that you use, CH3CO and the carboxyl, just as in the last step of ethanolic fermentation. The carboxyl comes off as CO2, and the hydrogen goes here, and then it's more complicated. It's a complicated reaction. So this CoA factor, small molecule, is attached here. So this is called acetyl-CoA. And so far we've produced, then, 1 CO2. So let's keep track of everything that's being produced. Here's our CO2 box. Here's our using up the NAD. So the green ones are from glycolysis. The blue ones now are from this Krebs cycle. And we have right away 2 NADH2s produced, which I'm calling NADH. And we have 2 ATPs, meanwhile, produced from glycolysis. So we're keeping track of all these things. There's our acetyl-CoA. Here's the CoA molecule. And you see there's a... This is acetyl-CoA, actually. And the acetyl is these 2 carbons at the end, like this tail of this, a pretty big molecule. You can see it's, again, like a nucleotide with phosphates. It's got a ribose. It's got a base, right? And then it's got this kind of an amide structure. And this part is called pantothenic acid. And when you make CoA by a pathway, you take pantothenic acid and you attach it to this phosphorylated, strangely phosphorylated base. And then you have CoA. And if you put the acetyl group down, as we just did, you have acetyl-CoA. This pantothenic acid we can't make. E. coli can make it. We can't make, so we have to take vitamin B5 or pantothenic acid. Just trying to make it relevant. There's the acetate group. So now we're here. We have our acetyl-CoA, and we have these boxes starting to get filled. The next thing that happens is this 2-carbon acetyl-CoA gets connected to this 4-carbon dicarboxylic keto acid. It has an English name of oxaloacetic acid. It doesn't help you too much. The name doesn't help you that much. But that's that. There it is, oxaloacetic acid. And the connection is made to the top of it there across this double bond. So you get an OH, and you have your acetyl group connected by its CH3 over here to form a tricarboxylic acid. So this pathway, discovered by Krebs and sort of incredible biochemistry of the time, he didn't know it was a cycle, right? Is sometimes called the tricarboxylic acid cycle. And this particular tricarboxylic acid is citric acid, same thing as in lemonade. And so it's sometimes called the citric acid cycle. They're all synonymous. So now we have something bigger, and we have a loose end. For every glucose molecule, we had 2 pyruvates, and we had to borrow some oxaloacetate. The acetocitric then undergoes... Here we have some little marks here so we can follow the fate of this acetyl-CoA molecule, which is derived from these 2 carbons of pyruvate. So we get an isomerization. This OH moves from the middle to one end. It's now isocitric acid, appropriately named. And then the isocitric acid, that OH, is going to be oxidized, again, by NAD. And at the same time, we're going to get the CO2 given off from the bottom here. So at the bottom, is it the bottom? No, it's the middle. So we have instead of a COH, we have a C double bond O. So we have a 5-carbon dicarboxylic acid, right? And that's called alpha-ketoglutaric acid. These seem like strange names, but produces it. Oxaloacetate, alpha-ketoglutaric acid, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. You know. They become familiar. And you get CO2, so we have another CO2 that's given off. We've used these two oxaloacetates, so we have a new box to tie up. There's our second CO2. Now, this alpha-ketoglutaric acid having been made, it goes right away another oxidation. We get CO2 given off. This time it's from the end, and we end up, since we lost the carbon, we end up with a 4-carbon compound. This is actually a couple of reactions in here, so it's somewhat simplified. And we have succinic acid, which we had met before, a simply dicarboxylic acid. CO2 came off over here, so we should have another one coming up in our box here. There it is. And we have another NAD, so it should be another NADH2. It is. And then we have something else going on here. GDP, oh, by the way, by this time, two CO2s here, because there's two pyruvates per glucose, two here, two here. We have completed, by this stage of the Krebs cycle, the conversion of glucose to CO2. We didn't use water. There's no oxygen. But that part of it is done. Now we have in this square GDP and phosphate goes to GTP. Looks like ADP goes to ATP, and indeed it's very similar. The G just means it's guanine instead of adenine as the base. It's slightly different, but energetically they're equivalent. And indeed there's an enzyme in the cell that'll catalyze the reaction. This GTP that was made can react with ADP to form GDP and ATP. Right? Just change that phosphate. Since the structure of the two is virtually the same in terms of the triphosphate, the delta G naught of this reaction is about zero. So we can easily keep drawing off this GTP as it's made and make ATP out of it. So I'm going to count this. Count this as an ATP, even though it says G. It should have shown up here, but I guess it's a little delayed. Now we're at succinic acid. Notice our acetate, our acetyl-CoA atoms are still here in succinic acid, even though we've produced all this CO2. Granted, the first CO2 came from this COOH of pyruvate, but these two guys came from the oxaloacetate. We were counting on paying back that oxaloacetate, I think. We borrowed it, we're going to have to pay it back, and here we have ripped it apart and used its CO2 down here. But let's go on. Succinic acid goes to fumaric acid. Again, we have an oxidation, except it's across these two carbons in the middle. We're going to take off two hydrogens. That's a little harder to do. So we use a different oxidizing agent, FAD, which is better at this, and for energetic reasons. So we have this C double bond O. All the others were across OH. We're across pulling things off of OHs to form C double bond O's. Here we're forming a carbon-carbon double bond, so it's a little different. And this is the reaction we talked about before, succinic dehydrogenase, and it's in this direction. You dehydrogenate it, you make fumaric acid, trans unsaturated dicarboxylic acid. And you get FAD going to FADH2. So what's FAD? It's different from NAD. It plays the same role, but chemically quite different. Here's a picture. So it's got, it's got again some of this adenine ribose phosphates and ribose again. But the business end is up here, these three rings. And in this case, the hydrogens with their electrons are going to add right to this triple link structure. So you indeed really have NADH2, really have FADH2, unlike the NADH, which doesn't really have two hydrogens. Okay, so we put this in our oxidation factor box. This is a little premature. Because I can pull it back. We're here. Fumaric acid. The fumaric acid is kind of this symmetrical molecule. Already it's symmetrical here at succinic acid. So we don't know. I mean, if I just turn this around on the screen, we wouldn't know which end really has these two labeled carbons. We don't know where they are here either. They're either here and here at the bottom, or they're here and here at the top. And they're equivalent, so it's like 50-50, the way we're looking at it. Because the next step is going to introduce, again, asymmetry around this carbon, right? Four different groups, because we're going to add water. So we have, across this double bond, so we have an H down here and an OH up here across this double bond, and we have malic acid. not maleic acid, it's malic acid. Malic acid is a 4-carbon dicarboxylic acid, right? And it's got this hydroxy dicarboxylic acid. We do another oxidation right on this OH, convert it to acetyl double bond O, we have this dicarboxylic, 4-carbon dicarboxylic keto acid. The only way you can draw it is, in fact, oxaloacetate. So we have our oxaloacetate back. It's not the one we borrowed. It's got different carbons in it. The cell doesn't care. We borrowed one. We gave one back. It looks like oxaloacetate to the cell, and indeed it is oxaloacetate. And we got another NADH2. Right. And we're back here, and we can accept now another acetyl-CoA, and we can just spin this thing. Spew out that CO2. And what do we have? We have a whole bunch of NADH2, I'll tell you that. And we have a little bit of ATP, one ATP for every turn of the cycle, two ATPs for glucose that was poured into this cycle. Eventually, if we kept spinning this, these labeled molecules, which are now, these labeled carbons, which are now either up here, or the half of them are up here and half of them are down here, half the oxaloacetates have the labeled carbons at the top and the other half at the bottom. And now, in the second cycle, they're going to start to show up as CO2. So eventually, your CO2 from glucose and pyruvate and acetyl-CoA are going to be produced because the only carbons you have to produce them. But in the first turn, they're actually just borrowed. So what do we have? From our overall reaction of glycolysis plus one turn of the Krebs cycle, we have glucose first goes to 2-pyruvate, and then it goes to 6 CO2s. We've produced, per glucose, 5 NADH2s in here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, times 2 for each per glucose molecule, and 2 FADH2s per glucose molecule. I got that. We've got 4 ATPs, 2 from glycolysis, 2 from this GTP business at the bottom of the Krebs cycle. And we have still the oxidation problem. We haven't brought oxygen in. So now we're going to bring in oxygen, so we have to reoxidize and pay back our NADH2s and NADs and FADs that we used. So our next step then is to follow the oxidation of all these NADH2s and FADH2s. Let's consider the overall reaction. It's going to be oxygen and NADH2. We're going to use 1O and 2 of these H's and form H2O. And to get back our NAD, that's what we want to do. What's the delta G naught of that reaction? Wow, minus 53 kilocalories per mole. So we're going to get plenty of, well, we know we have to get that 686, so this is where it's coming in, right? If we would couple this, if we couple this to ADP going to ATP, we could surely get 7 kilocalories per mole out of it. But it would be a coupled reaction. But we would lose 46 kilocalories per mole. It'd be very inefficient. Plus, we'd be producing all this heat, which would be another problem. So that's not the way nature has done it. Rather than doing a direct coupled reaction, nature has produced quite a fanciful scheme for tapping into this 53 kilocalories per mole of energy. Those electrons that are going to be transferred from NADH2, I'm losing my power already, to NAD, to oxygen, this reaction is broken up not to one arrow, but a series of many arrows, many smaller reactions, smaller energy-releasing reactions. And that's called the electron transport chain. As we transport electrons from the NADH2 to oxygen finally and get water. And we have all these reactions, all of which are going downhill on this energy scale. This is handout 8.3. So let's just take a couple of these. Something called FMN. Okay, it's going to accept the electrons and we can get FMNH. And you get plus H plus, and you get NAD back. So you've repaid your NAD, but you've just passed the buck to FMN. Now FMNH is the reduced form. And you can see these arrows switch at every time. Now the electrons are up here. They started out down here. Now they're up here in FMNH. Now the FMNH is going to react with an iron in something called an iron sulfur protein, but there's a protein called, having an iron at plus 3. It's going to accept these electrons, and it's going from plus 3 to plus one electron, from plus 3 to plus 2. So you need two of these proteins to take two electrons, right? And here, for the first time, we see that it's really the electrons that are doing the oxidation, the movement of electrons, because there's no protons involved here. We're adding an electron to iron plus to ferric to make ferrous, like rust, right? This is what oxygen does. So now we have the electron here. This is only plus 2, so it's got this extra electron. And we go to coenzyme Q. Coenzyme Q is actually, these are proteins. Coenzyme Q is not a protein. It's a small molecule. It's shown down here. Coenzyme Q. Also called ubiquinone. So coenzyme Q has got this business end, which is the is going to accept the electrons in this conformation of this ring and two oxygens. The electrons come in. It takes protons from the surround and makes these OH. So it became reduced. So and then look at the edge of this. This is a carbon, 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 CH3, carbon, 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 CH3. There's a long hydrocarbon, and this can go on. So it's about 50 carbons in this tail. So this is not going to be soluble. This is like a lipid. It's not going to be soluble in water, and is in fact found in a membrane, as we'll see, as indeed are all of these proteins are in a membrane. So this is a small molecule that's swimming around in a membrane. Now we go to cytochrome. So cytochrome is a protein. I show you the structure here. It looks sort of like hemoglobin. Indeed, it's like a single subunit of hemoglobin. And it's got a heme group held as a prosthetic group in the middle. And that iron in the heme group is going, in this case, take on an electron. So you go again from Fe plus 3 to Fe plus 2. And then you give it up to another iron sulfur protein and another cytochrome, a slightly different protein. And then you get another cytochrome and another cytochrome, all with different names. Cytochrome C1, cytochrome C, cytochrome A, cytochrome A3. Finally, cytochrome A3 is the guy that interacts with oxygen, gives up the electrons from its plus 2, which is the has the extra electron, to oxygen and forms water. So all of these steps are energetically favorable in small packets, and the reaction as a whole, we know what it is, minus 53 kilocalories per mole. This flavin in FMN is very similar to the FAD molecule we just looked at. It's got these three rings. So, but so that's conversion to another small molecule, but it's done by an enzyme. All of these reactions are highly organized in the cell. These three enzymes are connected in one big complex. Then there's another complex here with the red line, and a final complex is these three complexes, 1, 3, and 4. We'll worry about 2 later. And they are located in our human skin cell, I'll switch to, they are located in the organelle, the mitochondrion. So here's my simplified view of the mitochondrion. Mitochondrion has no cell wall, but it has a double membrane. There's a membrane along the outside called the outer membrane. It's highly porous. And we won't need to talk about it too much. Then there's the inner membrane, which is like a real membrane. It's not porous. And this membrane just doesn't look like this gray area here, but rather is invaginated into something called Christi. Single one is Christa. So that this whole mitochondrion is just filled with this inner membrane. Here's an actual picture of a mitochondrion, electron micrograph. So you can see throughout it all this layers and layers of membrane. But still, there's the membrane, and then outside of the outer layer is outside the mitochondrion, even though it's inside the outer membrane. You consider outside the inner membrane. So that would be over here and over here, over here. And then we have the stuff that's still inside. There is an inside. That's called the matrix. So these cristae push into the matrix. The Krebs cycle enzymes are actually in the mitochondria. Glycolytic enzymes are in the cytoplasm out here. So there's this physical separation. The electron transport chain complexes of enzymes and proteins are in the mitochondrial inner membrane. It's all along these Christi also. I show them here for simplicity. Now, the key point, where this is all going, is that as the electrons are transferred from NADH2, say coming in over here, and then ending up in oxygen over here, all these little reactions, at many of these steps, a proton, which is sitting here, gets specifically transferred outside of the membrane. How does that work? Here's an artist's rendition of this. Here's our complex one. It's a bunch of these proteins. As the electron is accepted here and goes through these several reactions, concomitant with that, four hydrogen ions are kicked out. As they get kicked out, they build up. And so you're still kicking them out, and you're kicking them out. They want to flow back in. It's hard to kick them out if there's a lot more outside here. By mass action, they will want to flow. Whatever this channel or whatever is, they want to go back in. So it takes energy to kick them out. And that energy is being provided by that transfer of the electron, which was running downhill on that energy diagram just before. So the energy is used in some way, and I'll show you an idea of that in a minute, to kick out protons outside and build up a gradient, therefore, of more hydrogen ions outside than inside. Or, if you will, a depletion of hydrogen ions inside. So inside the mitochondrion, the hydrogen ion concentration is going to what? You get less hydrogen ions, so it's going to increase, right? Indeed, the pH inside the mitochondria could be, say, 8, and over here outside it could be, say, 7. So that's a tenfold difference in hydrogen ion concentration, that one pH unit. Right? And we go here to number 3. There's that coenzyme Q that's floating around here. It's not a protein. It's that one step that's not a protein. Right? And coenzyme Q ferries the electron over here to complex 3, where again 4 hydrogen ions can be kicked out. And then through a bridge of cytochrome C's, finally to F4, and a couple more protons are kicked out, and finally we get our electrons delivered to oxygen. So this is what's going on in the mitochondrial membrane. Here's an idea of how this might be working. The hydrogen ions are bouncing around inside. This is inside the matrix. And so there's a binding site for a proton, say, on one of these electron transport chain proteins. This is highly schematic now. And then it's sitting there. It's still sort of on the inside. But then the electron is added to this protein, and it introduces a conformational change. Let's say the protein is relaxed, but it gets this electron, and suddenly it changes into a less energetically favorable situation. But because the electron came on, you pay for it by the delta G naught of that reaction. So it's favorable for the electron to add, so the protein can now take on a different conformational state, and so the energy has sort of been captured momentarily in this new conformational state. And that state is such that the proton no longer has access to the inside, only has access to the outside. So it just diffuses out. Then the electron leaves, and this protein or protein complex relaxes back to its original state, ready to take on another proton. So this is like a pump. The proton pumps. Right? And although the details of this not completely understood, a lot of it has been pretty well confirmed. There are proton pumps other places too. So we have, at the end of the electron transport chain, built up this proton gradient outside, and now so the energy of the whole electron transport chain, now completely used, it's been transferred to building up this gradient of protons on the outside. As if we use the energy to make electricity, to run a pump, to push water up behind some big dam at a high potential relative to gravity. Right? And now we want to tap that energy in the dam. So we're going to let these protons then run back, and they're going to run back through these other lollipop-like structures called F0, F1 structures. And this is where the ATP comes in. finally. By virtue of the hydrogen ions running back into the matrix from the outside where they've built up, the only way they can get in is through this a channel, or it's an effective channel, but it's again a bunch of proteins that constitute this lollipop. What's that look like? This is called the ATP synthetase. I think maybe I'll come back to this if I have time. This is some of the evidence that all this is true. You can read it if you want. Before we knew anything about how the ATP synthetase works, Peter Mitchell said, this is the way it works. This is basically the way it works. Somehow, when the hydrogen ions get back in through these lollipops, ATP is made. I don't know how, but this is how ATP is made, by using oxygen to oxidize NADH2. It's called phosphorylation. That's oxidative. Oxidative phosphorylation, or OxPhos. This is how ATP is being made, and you could quantify how much ATP is being made for every oxygen molecule used, for every glucose molecule used, and people did lots of experiments. This is like even in the 20s and 30s, they were doing those kind of measurements. They knew we were getting ATP out of it. But Mitchell, people were looking for, you know, coupled reactions. Compound X gets phosphorylated, maybe in several places, and trying to do it sort of the standard way of coupled reactions. And Mitchell had this idea that it's this very indirect way of making this gradient of protons. You know, nobody believed it. This was already in the 50s. Nobody believed him. He couldn't get his grants funded. Luckily, he was rich. And so he built his own lab, right, on his estate in England. And down in the basement, I like to think of it as sort of like a Frankenstein kind of thing. He's there doing his experiments and getting evidence that this is in fact true. And he and others then finally got so much evidence, which I don't have time to go over, but you can look at it in the notes and in the slides I skipped through. And he finally got the Nobel Prize in 1961. Right? 1978, actually. Right? So this was in the 60s that he did the work. And he finally got the Nobel Prize. So it took a long time for this to be accepted because it's so fanciful. It happens to be true. What about E. coli? It has no mitochondria. E. coli is smaller than a mitochondrion, even. E. coli does it the same way, except it uses the whole cell. So it just has the inside of the cell and the outside of the cell. Right? You have these cristae that form around the membrane of E. coli, and it's got these same F0, F1 lollipops, and they have the same electron transport. The same electron transport is going on in E. coli. You're just depleting the cell of protons instead of depleting the mitochondria relative to the outside. So there's a gradient of protons always wanting to get back into the cell. The only way they can get back in is through the synthetase. Let's talk about the synthetase then. Very complicated protein. Look at it. Lots of subunits. This is a multimer, heteromultimer, all right. It has this basic structure here on the left, an anchor in the protein, so that's the stem of the lollipop, with this ring of C subunits that are mostly alpha helices, I think that's why they look like cylinders, connected to an A subunit, and then this strut that comes out that holds the whole thing together, the A subunit with its C subunits to this alpha and beta. These are like three alphas and three betas. Alpha, beta, alpha, beta, alpha, beta up here to form kind of a regular ring up here. And the whole thing is connected by this gamma subunit. So we're going to focus on the C, the gamma, and the alpha and betas. Because that's key to the getting ATP out of this flow through. Here's a space-filling model turned upside down. Well, you can see maybe how this gamma subunit is buried into this ring of alpha betas. I'm going to have many pictures here. Here's the first picture on the right again for reference. And here's a schematic of what's going on with the C subunits. The hydrogen ions now are here, they're outside on the bottom. They get guided, there's a channel here, they get guided through this green A subunit and delivered to the middle of this C subunit. Right? And when the proton binds to the C subunit, again, there's a conformational change. This is now driven, this conformational change, driven by the fact that there's so many hydrogen ions out here that they're, by mass action, forcing their way in. So this is where the gradient is being tapped. Right? And once that conformational change takes place, this whole business moves. One, a few degrees, I don't know, 10 or 15 degrees, whatever. This is about 14, I think, subunits. Actually, it differs in different organisms, so a little odd. 12 in some, 14 in another. Another way to look at it. The hydrogens now coming in from the outside. Here's the membrane. And they're turning. As they add here, it moves a little bit. Then another one adds to another proton, binds to the next C subunit. Meanwhile, the other side, you soon fill it all up with protons. The other side, they come off, right? And they come finally back into the inside. So the only way they can come in is to bind to a C subunit, wait their turn until this whole guy turns around, 360 degrees, and then they have the channel open for them to get out. And they just keep doing this. So they keep turning this C subunit structure. C subunit structure is firmly attached to this gamma rod, which itself is not attached, but is sort of embedded in these six alpha-beta subunits. Pretty complicated. Here's actual atomic force diagram, microscopy pictures of the 14 or so subunits of the C subunit. So they have a reality. And by looking at the structure of this thing, a scheme for how ATP could be produced from ADP has been proposed and pretty much confirmed. So here's just these protons. You can't see the protons, but there. This is a sort of artist's view, animated, of how the turning is taking place. Now we get to the nub of it. We'll take a top view of this alpha-beta business. Here's the gamma subunit stuck in the middle of these alpha-beta 1, alpha-beta 2, alpha-beta 3. So there are like three alpha-betas. Now, where should we start? We'll start here. This alpha-beta subunit has a binding site for ADP and phosphate, alpha-beta. And so they bind, rather loosely, but they bind. When the purple guy up here, we'll just focus on this top guy, but the same thing's happening down here, just a little bit out of phase. Purple, the purple alpha-beta dimer, right, binding loosely when it's in a conformation such that this point of the gamma subunit is in this position. But now this thing is moving because it's attached to the C subunits. And so it turns clockwise, and now it looks a little different over here. That induces a conformational change in the alpha-beta subunit here, such that now we have tight binding. So tight, the ADP and the PI essentially smash together. Right? Now, under these conditions, their concentration is effectively so high that the formation of ATP is favored. So now you have this red ATP by virtue of this smashing together because of a conformational change, which is driven by this gamma subunit, which is driven by the movement of those C subunits, which is driven by the protein gradient, which was produced by the electron transport chain, which came from the oxidation of glucose. Now, next. The gamma subunit continues to turn. Now we have yet a third conformation for this purple alpha-beta subunit, such that it has no binding site whatsoever for ATP and it just stretches out its surface, and so the ATP comes off. And finally, one more turn, and we're back to where we started. If you look at the conformation of the gamma subunit here, this is like a cam, right? And we're ready to bind loosely the ADP and phosphate again and start again. Same thing is happening over here, out of phase. So it's turning, accepting, ATP is being produced. Hard to believe, but true. Here's an artist's rendition. See if this works. So we know the structure. See, this was gotten from the structure. We know the structure of these guys. It's supposed to be uncontinuous. hug up. Well, you got a little teaser anyway. You see the cam? The alpha, beta, yellow, and red. Three different conformations. What's that? I lost my place, didn't I? Wow. That's an artist's rendition, but based on the actual space-filling model, so it's using the real structures. But that was the idea, that this whole thing is moving. It's like a motor, like a generator. How about if we test it? How could we test that? Let's take this F0, F1. Let's turn it upside down and attach the end of it to a glass slide. We can do this. Oh, I need to be in... where is it? I don't want to go all the way back. I lost my little... Oh, there it is. Okay, that's better. So first thing we do is we attach it to a slide. Then we take off the C subunits. Now, this is a hard experiment to understand. We detach it from the C subunit, so we just have the cam and these alpha betas that where the ATP is being made. Now we attach to this a big long arm, much longer than this actually, to our cut end here. It's made up of proteins called actin, which form fibers in our cells. So we have this very long arm, maybe stretches out to about here, relatively. There's another view of it. And now we decorate this arm, or it was decorated already, with fluorescent groups. So we can see it under the light microscope. Light microscope, you can't see single molecules, but you can see the light from single molecules. So this is actually pretty long, right? And will show up in the light microscope as a bar of fluorescence. Right? So this one long molecule attached to this one relatively small, you know, just about 10 proteins or so connected together here. And now we're going to do the hard part. We're going to try and run this whole reaction reverse. Everything's reversible. So let's consider this reaction, and let's start here. This is the same diagram with different decorations here. So we have the cam over here. We have this in the non-binding state, but now we add a tremendous amount of ATP. So the ATP is going to wait a little while, that this form is constantly bumping into this purple subunit. As soon as a conformational change might by chance occur, then it's going to force its way in. And by being in here compared to here, per force, the cam must have to be in a different conformation, right? The conformation is consistent with the ATP binding site as opposed to no binding site. So by putting in a bunch of ATP, running the reaction backwards, we are forcing the conformational change by a high ATP concentration, which is forcing the cam to move. Right? Now, because we have so much ATP waiting here, we can get the hydrolysis reaction being driven in the reverse direction just by mass action. So here there's no change. They're still squished together, but they're separated. As this conformational change occurs, then the cam will change again. Right? And then come back here. These will be lost because they're very few, and the ATP is constantly knocking at the door to drive the reaction in reverse. So before it was a clockwise motion that was predicted from the structure. In this case, running in reverse, we expect a counterclockwise motion. So can we see that motion if we look at this bar, right? Let's see. Notice, it's even pausing like every 120 degrees or so, right? It's three confirmations. But waiting, then it went through two, right? To me, think of the most spectacular movies in biology. What would you pick? Fertilization, mitosis, you know, all those DNA. Does this beat mitosis? It does for me. Mitosis is just cell biology. This is biochemistry in action. Okay. Let's do the numbers. Each of the three complexes pumps enough hydrogen ions to form one ATP. So you get three ATPs for every... It just works out that the number of protons turning that C subunit, enough are enough protons are pumped out here to drive it enough to allow enough turning of that ATP synthetase to form one ATP. So you end up with three ATPs for every pair of electrons that pass through the full electron transport chain. And so it's three ATPs for every NADH2. For FADH2, it's a little less. It's two. But there's only one of those. And I'm not going to dwell on that. But just to say that the FADH2 comes in finally to explain this complex two, it comes in over here, so it missed out on this pumping. Because of the energetics of the situation, the reaction goes much more to completion if we start at two. This is too hard for that fumarate reaction to go. So the succinate fumarate reaction is actually right here, not even in the matrix. It's on the surface, inside surface of the mitochondrial membrane. Here's from your 8-6 handout. Sort of a summary of the whole business. I think I've gone into it in a lot of detail. I think it's hard for you to absorb it from my words, but if you look and do the problems, and you look at this diagram, we found it very useful to just abbreviate the Krebs cycle here. All these FADs and NADs being reduced and oxidized, the ATP being formed. And if we add up all of these NADs with three ATPs each, and the FAD reaction with two ATPs each, and then over here, substrate level phosphorylation. The old way, which was the direct phosphorylation of ADP in coupled reactions, we got for every half glucose now, just to prevent you from memorizing, half glucose, you have to figure it out, one ATP from glycolysis for half glucose, one ATP from the GTP in the Krebs cycle. So there's two ATPs by substrate level phosphorylation. All the rest comes from this oxidative phosphorylation, adds up to 15 ATPs, 17 ATPs from oxidative phosphorylation, 15 from the NAD and 2 from the FAD. So 17 plus these two is 19. Or per glucose, for full glucose molecule, it would be then, and here's the arrows. It will be 38. Okay, 19 times 2, we just go back to a full glucose. 38 per glucose. So that's a lot more than 2 from fermentation. Also, you can see that this is on the top is in the cytoplasm and the bottom is in the mitochondria. In E. coli, it really is 38. In eukaryotes, it's not a big deal, it's a detail, but it's a little less because of this separation between cytoplasm and the mitochondrial matrix. You have to bring in that NADH2 that was, in order for it to be go through oxphos, it has to be brought in from the cytoplasm where it's produced in glycolysis, cross the membrane and get in. It's done by an indirect mechanism, and it costs you 2 ATP. So we only get 36. But this is small potatoes compared to 2. The efficiency here, is once again a little better than most gasoline engines. Here's 37%. We have 686 to work with. We have 36 if we figure the lower number in our cells, 252, 36 times 7. So we get 37% efficiency, and we have used all the glucose. But don't sell the fermentation short. It works. Okay, so I have 2 minutes to talk about all the rest of intermediary metabolism. Let's say you have this on your handout. It's just a schematic to say that similar kinds of pathways, you can catabolize starch and fats and amino acids and proteins. I won't talk about, I don't have time to talk about the amino acids, which have a nitrogen, makes it a little more complicated, but you get energy from proteins. The amino acids can be converted to Krebs cycle or glycolytic intermediates, and they run down and they get these energy from that. We know almost all of these reactions. There's serine. There's a biosynthesis from glucose to serine. There it is. Glucose, serine. Right? This is the nitrogen business. We have one big question remaining. Okay? How are we going to make... Bear with me for one more minute. How are we going to make our... We know how to make everything now, right? We know how to make polysaccharides using these proteins, put on glucose, put on xylose, whatever. We know how to make fats. We can do it with similar pathways. How about the proteins? How can we make the proteins? Here's a protein we want to make. It starts with methionine. We're going to make a particular sequence. So we can have an enzyme that takes valine, puts it onto methionine. Because as we know, we have to do that. And then we have another enzyme that will add histidine to valine, different substrates, right? And another enzyme will take leucine to metvale his. But we get into trouble here because each of those enzymes is a protein. It also has to be made. So we run into an infinite loop here. How are we going to make those proteins? They're going to have separate enzymes. We cannot make the proteins using these metabolic pathways the way we have and just enzymes with substrates. We are lacking also the information for how to do it. So we have solved these two problems in my part of the course here. How to get the reactions to go fast, how to get the reactions to go at all in the right direction, and now we have a problem, how do we get the information for the primary sequence of that protein? And the primary sequence tells it how to fold into the three dimensions. And the three dimension tells it how to do its job, how to make an ATP synthetase, all from the three-dimensional structure of these proteins, which is ultimately the primary structure of the proteins. So we are lacking, how do we get the information? Now we have a problem not of chemistry, but of information. And that answer lies in nucleic acids, and Professor Moskowitz will tell you all about it.